Okay, so yesterday I told you about this couple that we had met at breakfast, and she ended up actually having grown up in the same hometown that I grew up in, and her parents went to my church, and her sister's my Facebook friend. And so this morning at breakfast, and all that was in the little tiny hamlet of St. Albans, West Virginia. And then this morning, I met a young couple who went to Marshall University, where my brother and a bunch of my family members went. And then as I was coming into the tab, a lady came and introduced herself to me, saying that she grew up in Huntington, West Virginia. So for all of you who are not from West Virginia, why not? Because it seems like there is a disproportionate number of Mountaineers here in the place this week, so we're just delighted to make some of those fun connections. And it's very possible that the young couple I met this morning was at Marshall the same time that my niece and her husband that she met at Marshall were there. And so you just see some of those little fun connections, and it's just kind of like, wow. People talk about it really is a small world. And if you ever go to Disneyland, you get that song in your head, you know, that the worst of all possible earworms, it's a small world after all, and it never goes away. Well, I guess it really is a small world after all, whether you've been to Disneyland or not. So anyway, enough of that. We're going to continue with Solomon today. Just to kind of get started, over the years, one of the things at which my wife has been most successful is ensuring that I watch a disproportionate amount of home improvement shows on HGTV. And so, you know, we watch all that stuff. Back in the day, it was This Old House, and then it was Home Time, and then it was Homes on Homes from Canada, and then the Property Brothers, and of course, Fixer Upper from down in Waco, and Chip and JoJo, and all that stuff. And our current favorite of those is Hometown. Ben and Aaron Napier down in the little town of Laurel, Mississippi. And the kind of the theme around the show, if you've never seen it, and they're a Christian couple, really neat kids. The theme around the show is this is an old town. It's a rundown little town. It's kind of seen its better days, but they're kind of refurbishing the town one house at a time. And it's really kind of a cool thing. But the deadlock guarantee is no matter how big the project is, whatever they start the beginning of the show with, by the end of the show, it's going to be completed. And it'll be beautiful. And people will be saying, this isn't our house, is it? Well, no, it's your house. It's just you've never seen it like this before. Well, a few months ago, they did something different. Guys, I'm going somewhere with this, so hang with me. The ladies are like, the guys are like, oh, here we go. It's like being home. Here we go. So they did a thing called Hometown Takeover. And if any of you saw any of this, they went to this little town, Wetumpka, Alabama. And they said, we're going to renovate the whole town by redoing 12 strategic locations and building civic pride. And again, another small town in the South that's kind of run down and lost its energy and stuff. And so over the course of 6 weeks in projects that lasted for 4 months, they redid a town. And what was so interesting is that almost every episode you'd see somebody saying, man, I think these people are crazy. This is such a huge project. This is such a big project. How do you expect to do this in four months? And I mean, just over and over again, every episode, this is such a big project, such a big project. But you know what? By the end of that thing, you could look and you could see the impact of this way too big building project on this tiny little town that just needed some help. It was so useful and it was so worthwhile. Well, that's a big building project. However, at a totally different scale, back in the late 1880s, 1889 to be exact, a bunch of the uber wealthy Vanderbilts, you know the name Vanderbilt, well, very, very wealthy family, a bunch of the uber wealthy Vanderbilts had kind of gotten into this rhythm where each one of them was building their summer homes. You see the air quotes, summer homes. And Charles Vanderbilt, Charles or George? George Vanderbilt II. George Vanderbilt II decided he was going to build his summer home. And he got some land down in North Carolina. And he began what would be a six-year project that would result in what is now known as the Biltmore Estate. That is his summer home. It is the largest privately owned residence in America. But here's how big this project was. During construction, they were manufacturing on site 32,000 bricks a day. By the time they were done, it had 250 rooms, 35 of which were bedrooms, 43 of which were bathrooms, over 178,000 square feet of floor space for his summer home. It is the largest privately owned residence in the United States and one of the largest building projects ever undertaken in America, which was privately funded. Now, for some strange reason, that brings us to Solomon. Because what we know about Solomon is that he was involved in a fairly major building project of his own, wasn't he? And we're going to see something about that today. And we're going to see some things about it that are okay. They're interesting. That's fine. Nice to know. But then I think we're going to see some other things that maybe have more to say to us than we would expect we would learn from somebody else's building project. So I'm going to encourage you to hang with us, because it may seem like, okay, here we go. But actually, I think there's something here for us that can speak into our lives, into our hearts, into our relationships with God in a surprising, unexpected kind of way. So, and as we start off in 1 Kings chapter 6, I'm going to read this verse, verse 1 of 1 Kings chapter 6, and it's going to feel like the biggest throwaway verse in the history of throwaway verses. And actually, it's one of the most important verses in the Old Testament. You'd never. In the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Okay, everybody may now stop yawning. This is not exactly the most soul-stirring verse in the Bible, right? And yet it is extremely strategic, and it's extremely strategic for one thing, and that is calibrating Bible history. Here we get benchmarks that allow us to build a somewhat accurate and meaningful timeline of events of the Old Testament. It's also kind of an insight into Jewish thinking. Because in Jewish thinking, everything in the world is watched through the lens of their history, and ultimately everything in their history is watched through the lens of the Exodus. So everything plays off of the Exodus. That is the seminal moment, the key moment, the critical moment in Israel's history. And so if this takes us all the way back. When Solomon took the throne and began the temple, it had been 480 years since the Exodus from Egypt. Now, if you'll think about that, 400 plus years since the Exodus, we know that before that it was 400 plus years that they were enslaved. So you have 400 plus years enslaved, 400 years plus in the land. Then we saw yesterday that there's 400 and so or so years between Solomon and Daniel. And then after the people return to the land, after the return from the exile, there's 400 and some years before Christ. So if you can kind of lock in this general number of 400 years more or less, you can kind of work your way through the history of the Old Testament in a way that'll actually make a little bit of sense. And as you think about all that, always keep in mind that the key moment is always the Exodus. This year, at Passover, in Jewish homes, around the world, before the feast can start, the young son has to go to the head of the household and say, "Why this feast?" And immediately at that moment, they begin to recount the story of the Exodus. Because that is the Israel-defining moment of Exodus, of freedom from slavery. And everything in their history plays out of that moment. So as we come into the temple, even as important as the temple was going to be, and we'll see why it was so important in a moment, but even as important as the temple was going to be, nothing rose to the level of the Exodus as something that would define who Israel was. They were God's chosen people. How do you know? Because God called them out of slavery and into a homeland. Everything works off of that. And because of that, we get dating that goes back to the Exodus, and then from the Exodus to Solomon, and from Solomon to Daniel, and from Daniel to Jesus. And we have a roadmap with which to work our way through history. So this seemingly innocuous verse actually has great value in helping us work our way through this stuff. However, when we start thinking about the temple, and Solomon, it says, would begin building the house of the Lord. As Solomon begins building the temple, we need to make sure we understand what's happening here and why it's happening. Because for those of us who live on this side of the cross and resurrection, for those of us who are followers of Jesus, it would be easy to make the mistake of thinking that the temple is kind of like the moral equivalent to a church building. And nothing could be further from the truth. Because the significance that was attached to temple and still today is attached to temple in the Jewish world is so far beyond what we see the church building to be. It really goes back to, again, the Exodus. And at the foot of Mount Sinai, the people hear from God through Moses that they are to construct a tabernacle, the forerunner of the temple. And this tabernacle, the tent of meeting, it was sometimes called, would house the Ark of the Covenant. It would be the place where God's presence would be represented among the people. It would be the place where sacrifices would be offered. It would be that place. And God's intent for Israel was for the tabernacle and then later the temple that Solomon will build. It was God's intent that this would be the absolute center of Jewish national, spiritual, and religious life. So much so that when God gave them the blueprints for building the tabernacle, he didn't stop with the tabernacle itself. After he gave them the blueprints for the tabernacle, he then went on to say, now, when the pillar of cloud or pillar of fire moves, you pack everything up, you move. When it stops, it stops. The first thing you do, do not pass go, do not collect 200 shekels. The first thing you do, put up the tabernacle. Then you will arrange the tribes of Israel in order around the tabernacle. Why? Because it was a physical reminder in their physical environment that the tabernacle, which represented God among the people, was to be the center of Jewish life. Now, I think even the most optimistic and ambitious pastor in America does not expect the church building to be the center of the spiritual life of his people. If he does, he's misinformed. Because the church building has a totally different function than the temple did, and it has a tremendously different significance than what the temple did. So they had the tabernacle. It was a tent made out of skins and stuff like that. And so over time, it was lost. The Ark of the Covenant was still there. Now comes the time for Solomon to build the temple. Now, if you read Chronicles, and we saw yesterday that in Samuel and Kings, the focus is on the kings and the palace and what goes on there. But Chronicles, the focus is on the priests and the temple. In Chronicles, what we find out is all of the resources, all of the materials, all of the planning, all of the specifications for the temple were actually provided by David. David was the one who mapped out all of the stuff that was going to be needed to do it so that his son Solomon could follow him in a season of peace and build, as it says here in verse 1, the house of the Lord. So with all that kind of background stuff, look as we see verse 2, and this is where we start to get a little bit of the nuts and bolts, although there were no nuts and probably no bolts either. We get a little bit of the nuts and bolts of what the temple was going to be like. As for the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, its length was 60 cubits, and its width 20 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Now, let's just stop there. That's enough. There's stuff, more stuff about the nave, and then what comes after that, and what comes after that, and what comes after that. But just to get a sense of the scope of this, this is not the Biltmore. It's not as big as the Biltmore. It's not going to be as, in many ways, grand as the Biltmore, but it will be infinitely more important than the Biltmore. The temple is described as being 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 30 cubits high. Now, you probably know that it's generally understood that the length of a cubit was from the tip of a man's elbow to the tip of his middle finger, which is about 18 inches. So you multiply by 1.5, and so 60 cubits means about 90 feet long. And then 20 cubits means about 30 feet wide, and 30 cubits means about 45 feet high. So in the ancient world, this would have been a massive structure. A massive structure. And what's significant about it is that even in the building of the temple, it still reaches back into the Exodus because those dimensions are exactly double the dimensions of the tabernacle that God gave at Sinai. Exactly double. And the thinking is that because the tabernacle was a portable place of worship that moved with the people and so forth, and this is going to be a permanent structure for the people to have a center to their lives and a place to worship, this would be a more substantial place. And so all the sizes got doubled. And he begins building this thing. Now, the process of building it is staggering to think about because none of the technology that we take for granted was available to them. They didn't have any of that stuff. Plus, they didn't have all the raw materials that they were going to need in spite of everything David had provided for it. So Solomon contacts King Hiram of one of the northern kingdoms called Sidon, and they had access to the proverbial cedars of Lebanon, and the Sidonians were the best at harvesting that stuff. And so Solomon was going to send some workers to assist the Sidonians, and they were going to do this in a food for wood kind of an exchange thing. He was going to send food to Sidon and to Hiram, the king there, and they were going to send cedar from Lebanon back down for the interior of the temple. The temple itself was going to be made out of stone, cut stone. And what's so staggering about this, if you take some time this afternoon and read 1 Kings 6, what you find is that those stones were going to be formed at the quarry. There was not to be the sound of any hammers or picks or tools at the temple site. It was to be built in silence. Now this is extraordinary. Because what that means is they were going to have to do their measuring without modern technology, without modern tools. They were going to have to shape these stones at the quarry and then take the finished piece to the temple site where it could be moved into place, and it had to fit seamlessly. Because you couldn't do any adjusting because the sound of tools was not allowed. This is an extraordinary happening. And what's so interesting is if you go to Jerusalem today, and many of you have been to Israel, I know, because we've talked about it. But if you go to Jerusalem, a lot of people, they go to the Temple Mount. Well, on what once was the Temple Mount, there are two Muslim mosques today. And the place that the Jews venerate and revere is the Wailing Wall. And the Wailing Wall is the last remaining piece of the temple proper area. And it wasn't even part of the temple. It was just a retaining wall that was put up to create a platform where the temple could be built. To see the last remaining parts of the temple itself, you have to go underground into the tunnel system. And when you go down into the tunnel system, you see these stones that were quarried. And some of them are 50, 60 feet long. And they are perfectly shaped, and you see them on top of each other, and they fit together seamlessly. And you say, how could they do that? And yet that was the task that they had been given, because they were building the house of the Lord. And so the construction begins. We'll find out in a minute that it's going to go on for 7 years. So it took 1 year longer than it took for the Biltmore to be built. And by the way, the built in Biltmore is B-I-L-T, not B-U-I-L-T. So it's not he built more. It's just a name, Biltmore. But that's extra. I just thought I'd throw that in. For 7 years, they work on this. But here's what I want you to get. And this is where I think there's something for us. And I say that very cautiously because I think one of the things that happens far too often in our generation is we grab any verse that looks halfway decent and we try to make it fit into our world and our day as if that was specifically written for us in a moment in time. And the fact of the matter is all of the Bible is for us, but not all the Bible was to us. Some of it was written to a specific moment in history and to the people of that day. And so we need to be careful how we appropriate some of that stuff. And I know a lot of you are aware of all that, but I just throw that out there. But what I want you to see is this. While construction is going on, God speaks to Solomon. And this is actually the second of four times that God audibly speaks to Solomon during his life. The first we saw when God came to him in a dream and said, ask whatever you want. And we saw what happened with that on Monday in our first look into Solomon's life. Now we come into this, and this is the second time now God speaks to Solomon audibly. And I want you to listen to what he says, and I want you to listen to what he doesn't say, and then I want you to see if you agree with me about what I think it means by what he says and by what he doesn't say. All right? So as we listen to words from God spoken to Solomon, go to verse 11. Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon saying, concerning this house which you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and execute my ordinances and keep all my commandments by walking in them, then I will carry out my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the sons of Israel, and I will not forsake my people. Now, it's very interesting. He starts off by saying, Solomon, I want to talk to you about this temple you're building. All right? He says, concerning the house which you are building. That's how God starts. And then if you read the rest of the words, he doesn't say anything about the building. He says, I want to talk to you about the building, but he doesn't talk to him about the building. He is not telling Solomon, this is a bad idea, stop construction, I don't want you to build a temple. He's not doing that. What he's doing, I suspect, is he is correcting false impressions, wrong understandings, missed ideas. Because since the tabernacle had been the center of Jewish life, it was also the center of the ritual of Judaism and all of the religious activity and all the religious stuff. All that stuff was rooted and grounded in the tabernacle. All of that stuff was going to be rooted and grounded in the temple. That's where all the sacrifices, everything was going to take place. The heart of Judaism was the temple. And it would be really easy to miss that target and to make the temple more than it was intended to be. Because remember, like the tabernacle before it, the temple was not to be God among the people or the presence of God among the people. It was to symbolize the presence of God among the people. It was not to be a substitute. It was to be a symbol. And that's why, I think, when God says, I want to talk to you about this temple, he doesn't talk to him about the temple. When he talks to him about the temple, what he talks to him about is what the temple is there for. The temple was there to facilitate them in developing a relationship with the God of Exodus. And so he doesn't talk to him about the building. He doesn't talk to him about, boy, I really like that one stone that one guy cut out the other day. That looked great. Now, there's nothing about the temple in here. It's everything about don't lose sight of the purpose. Don't make it more than it's supposed to be. The focus of your attention is to be relationship with me. That's just a tool to help you get there. And so everything he says is about what an Old Testament Jewish individual would have understood to be the components of relationship with God. He talks about walking in my statutes, executing my ordinances, keeping my commandments by walking in them. And by the way, even though we are not under the law of Moses because Jesus came and fulfilled the law, there's still an element of obedience that is the outward demonstration of our response to the God of our Exodus. Because Jesus said, go into all the world and make disciples of every nation, baptizing them and teaching them to obey all that I commanded you. So the Christian life is not obedience optional. The Christian life, however, is obedience directed. It is obedience as a response to God and what he has done for us. And that's exactly what Solomon's being told here. And if you go back to chapter 3, where we were on Monday, in the first time that God spoke to Solomon, he says pretty much the exact same thing. If you will keep my commandments, if you will keep the statutes, if you will walk with me, build a relationship with me, then I'm going to keep the promises that I made to your father David. And here he goes from if to then to and I will dwell among the sons of Israel. I will dwell among the sons of Israel. Just like you saw the pillar of cloud and pillar of fire over the tabernacle, just like you saw the Shekinah glory fill the tabernacle, if you build relationship with me, I will dwell with you. I will dwell with you. You will be my people and I will be your God. And that was the point from the very beginning. For them to be a people of God, not just a people who had yet another different God and yet another religious construct and yet another worship system. No, it was to be the people of the God living in relationship. That was the intent. And the tragedy is, even as God lines up for Solomon here, exactly what the temple is supposed to be for and what it's supposed to look like, by the time Jesus is on the scene after a couple of 400 plus year blocks of time, the entire temple process had devolved into exactly the opposite of what God wanted it to be. And it had become all about mechanics and all about ritualism and all about formalism and all about religious observance without heart obedience. The very thing God warns about is the very problem Jesus confronted when he stepped onto the scene in the first century. This is God giving a corrective. He's not saying don't build the house. That's not the point. The point is, don't build the house and then make it what it's not supposed to be. It is not a substitute for walking with me as my children, as my chosen people. So if you jump to the end of the chapter, it says, in the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. And in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished throughout all its parts and according to all its plans. So he was 7 years in building it. So now the temple's done. And Solomon's going to do some other stuff, but I want you to jump forward to chapter 8. Because they have a dedication of this temple space, this new place, not to be worshipped, but a place where worship could take place. And this was such a significant thing in the lives of the people, not only now, but also in Jesus' time. Remember that at the Exodus, it all keeps going back to that, at the Exodus, God gave to Israel the laws, and among the laws were these festivals that would come throughout the year, these feast times. And three times a year, at the three high feasts, in the spring, the feast of Passover or unleavened bread, the feast of first fruits, which we call Pentecost, and then in the fall, the feast of tabernacles or booths. At those three feast times, everybody's to come up to the temple. Everybody's to come up to this place that symbolizes the presence of God among the people. Why? For the exact same reason the people were to gather around the tabernacle, to once again orient themselves around God as the center of their lives. And so three times a year, everything stopped and everyone went uphill and everybody would go to the temple and everybody would worship and everybody would experience that thrice yearly recalibration around God as the focal point of their lives. This became such a high value for Israel that when the rabbis began putting the Old Testament together, they put the book of Psalms together, and if you've ever paid attention, you may have noticed that the book of Psalms is actually the five books of Psalms. Because if you'll look closely, you'll see book one, and then I think it's with Psalm 42, book two, and then and so forth and so forth. There are five books of Psalms. In the fifth book of Psalms, there is a subset of songs within the Psalter, and under every one of them, from 120 to 134, it has the little superscription, Songs of Ascent, songs for going up. These are the songs for festival. These are the songs that the people would sing on pilgrimage as they were going up to Jerusalem to come to the place of worship, to have their lives reoriented around God again. And every one of those psalms was to prepare them for that moment. That's how critical this was in Jewish life and thinking. That's how vital this was in the hearts and minds of the people. The temple was not to be worshipped. It was a place to facilitate worship. The temple was not to be a substitute for God. It was a symbol for God and a place where relationship with God could be developed and learned. The temple was of vital importance, but it was never to be more than God intended it to be. Now, when you move forward into chapter 8, you have all of this dedication stuff, and Solomon prays this really super long prayer. But once he finishes praying this prayer of supplication to God, he then declares a statement of blessing about God. And this statement of blessing has much to say to us. It's a statement of blessing that I'm going to commit to memory, because much like in Solomon's prayer, we saw some key components in that prayer that can inform how we pray today. I want you to know that in this statement of blessing, there are some key components that can inform how we grow in relationship with God today. So listen to this dedication blessing. It says, verse 54, it came about that when Solomon had finished praying this entire prayer and supplication to the Lord, he arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread toward heaven, and he stood and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, "Blessed be the Lord who has given rest to his people Israel. According to all that he promised, not one word has failed of all of his good promise, which he promised through Moses, his servant. May the Lord our God be with us as he was with our fathers. May he not," this is going to have a familiar ring, "leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to himself, to walk in all his ways, to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances which he commanded to our fathers. And may these words of mine, with which I have made supplication before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night, that he may maintain the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel as each day requires, so that all the people of the earth may know that the Lord is God. There is no one else. Let your heart," here it is. This is the purpose of the temple. You want to know what it's all about? It's right here. "Let your heart, therefore, be wholly devoted to the Lord your God." That's the point. That's a point. "Let your heart, therefore, be wholly devoted to the Lord our God, to walk in his statutes and to keep his commandments at this day." Now, If the entire goal is to have our lives reoriented around our God and refocused around our God, what are the elements of that, Solomon? And I could probably find 10 or 15 in here, much like the prayer the other day, but just the four I want you to lock into with me. The first is, blessed be the Lord who has given rest to his people. Blessed be the Lord who has given rest to his people. And you say, well, when did they get rest? Did they get rest because they built the tabernacle and then later they built a temple? Is that when they got rest? No, you got to remember, everything in their national memory is focused on the Exodus. You know when they got rest? They got rest when they were rescued from slavery. That's when they got rest. When they were freed from slavery, they had rest. And looking all the way back, he says, blessed be the Lord God who has given rest. Does that mean every day was a perfect day and everything was great? Of course not. What it means is there was this critical moment where we had no hope, and the God of heaven stepped in to our turmoil and our chaos, and he gave us rest. And as you push forward, you hear the voice of the Savior speak into our turmoil and our chaos and our confusion. You hear the voice of the one who called us out of enslavement to sin into relationship with the Father. And you hear him say, come to me, all you who labor and are weighed down with cares, I will give you rest. And you will find rest for your souls. What Solomon was celebrating from 400 years before, we celebrate from 2,000 years before. Because in his cross, we have found rest from our slavery and from our bondage and from our struggle and from our pain. And like Solomon, we should rise up and say, blessed be the God who's given us rest. Because this is a wearying world. It is a worrying world, but it is a wearying world. And in him, we find rest for our souls. Notice the second component, verse 57. May the Lord our God be with us. You know what he was praying for there? You got to get this. He was praying for Emmanuel. Emmanuel is the Hebrew word for God with us. May the Lord our God be with us. And you know what? He was, but not in the way that he would be. Because the way that he would be with them would come in Matthew chapter 1, when the angel would say to Joseph, you will call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins, and he will be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. God in human flesh, walking among his people, hearing their cries, drying their tears, healing their pain. God with us. What Solomon prayed for was realized when the Word became flesh and dwelt among us and we beheld his glory. The glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And what's so cool about it is there's this thing scholars like to call an inclusio, I-N-C-L-U-S-I-O, inclusio. And it's a fancy scholarly word for bookends. So in narrative, when you see an inclusio, you see this thing and then you see it repeated later, what that means is everything in between is defined by the inclusio. So you come to John chapter 8 and Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. And then early in John chapter 9, he says, I'm the light of the world. That's an inclusio. Everything between those two statements is intended to be defined by the understanding that Jesus is the light of the world. That's an inclusio. And what you need to understand, folks, is that what Solomon, the king of Israel, is appealing for here is exactly what Matthew, the writer of the most Jewish of the Gospels, does with his whole book, because the entire Gospel of Matthew is bookended by an inclusio. In chapter 1, it is, you will call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And at the end, Jesus says, lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And everything in between is marked out by this idea. You don't have to do it alone. Jesus is there every step of the way. What Solomon prayed for, we have. And not only do we have God with us in the sense of the Jesus who will be with us always to the end of the age, we also have the extra privilege of having God in us through the indwelling Holy Spirit. We get what Solomon wanted and more because of the cross and resurrection. The third component builds on the second, and it's the next phrase. May he not leave us or forsake us. Not only do we find rest in him, not only do we live in his presence, but we live in his presence knowing that he will be faithful. That he will be faithful. That he will not abandon us. No matter how dark it gets, no matter how hard it gets, when you're getting ready to get pitched into a fiery furnace, he is with us in the fire. We saw that the other night. He will not leave us or forsake us. And that is such a huge idea that the writer of Hebrews pulls it forward into Hebrews 13. Be content with this, for the Lord has promised, I will never leave you or forsake you. He is the God of rest, who calls us out of slavery into relationship with him so that we can live in his presence where he's with us, and that he will be faithful to us in all the moments of life. And then the last part, all the way down to verse 60. Why does all this happen? So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God. See, this was Israel's mission statement all along. They were to be a light to the Gentiles. We see it scattered throughout the Old Testament. They were to be a light to the nations. And instead of being a nation that became exhibit A to the watching world of what it looked like to be in relationship with the Creator, they became a nation that pulled inwardly, that isolated themselves and incubated themselves from the nations around them rather than bearing witness to the nations around them. The purpose all along, Israel, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless you. Go back to Abraham. Through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. But they hoarded those blessings to themselves and hated the people God had called them to shine light upon. And yet Solomon, once again, at the dedication of the temple that represented and symbolized the presence of God among the people, as he's dedicating the temple, he reminds them, don't forget why we're here. We're not just here for us. We're here for all of them. Which is why 85 years later, this is still Maranatha Bible and Missionary Conference. Because our call is to reach out, not to hide in. Solomon got that. And as he calls the people to be holy, devoted to God, can I suggest to you that the call to true devotion still means the same things? We cling to the one in whom we find rest. The one who is with us and in us. The one who will never leave us or forsake us. And the one who drives us out into the world so that the world may know that he is God. And there is no other. Solomon's blessing, I think, is for us a way to approach what it means to live in relationship with our God. And yes, some of it's going to be obedience, but that obedience is not rote. That obedience is not mechanical. That obedience is always our response to what He has done for us. Jesus said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." Pretty simple. But the reality is, in that true devotion to Him, we find rest. And we find His presence and His faithfulness. And we find a mission worth living for. Because it's His mission. The temple was an important building, but it was only a building. It was an important symbol, but it was never intended to be a substitute. Because what mattered most was the substance that that shadow represented, living in the presence of God. We see it in the Garden of Eden. As Adam and Eve walk with God in the cool of the day, living in His presence. We see it in the tabernacle when the Shekinah glory dwells. We see it in the temple representing God's presence among the people. We see it most perfectly in Jesus, God with us, the living physical embodiment of the eternal infinite God walking in dirt just like us. But the really good news is, where before there was a temple, 1 Corinthians 6 tells us that now our bodies are the temple. Because the presence of God dwells in us through His Spirit, our bodies are the temple. And the even better news is there's going to come a day when there's no more crying and no more tears and no more death and no more pain. And the Bible tells us in Revelation 21, and in that day, John says, I saw no temple there. Because God and the Lamb are its temple. And we will be perfectly in His presence forevermore. And I don't know about you, but that sounds pretty good to me. That's something worth looking forward to. That's something worth celebrating. When we stand in His presence, whole, forever, with Him. Let's pray together. Lord, I thank You for giving visionary leadership who saw the need for a temple and built one to be a center to Israel's life. And I thank You for visionary leaders who provide for us physical spaces that can be a platform for us growing and deepening our relationship with You. But Father, don't ever let us lose sight that the shadow is not the substance. You are the substance. Living in Your presence is the reality we long for. So as we learn to walk with You and live in You and have You living in us, may we find rest in this helter-skelter world. May we find Your powerful presence and the assurance and the comfort that only You can give. May we rest in Your faithful promise that You'll never leave us or forsake us. And may You give us the courage and the strength and the wisdom and the grace and the humility to take what we have found in Jesus to a world that needs to know Him. Father, thank You that we have gathered this morning in a tabernacle. Each of us temples in which You dwell. May we live out that reality as we walk with You. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.